Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
National liberation, national renaissance, the restoration of nationhood to the people, commonwealth.
France Fanon and the violence of colonialism.
Whatever may be the headings used or the new formulas introduced, decolonization is always a violent phenomenon.
Should there be limits to violence in the service of liberation?
Is violence the only language colonial oppressors understand?
Shut up! Oh, come and see the violence inherent in the system! Help, help, I'm being repressed!
How did France Fanon influence anti-colonial and national liberation movements around the world?
He was the first within the revolutionary movement, within the anti-colonial movement, to raise these kinds of questions.
Our guest is Nigel Gibson from Emerson College.
He was a philosopher, and he raised these questions concretely. I think that's why Fanon is still relevant.
France Fanon, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hi, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being a partner in Philosophy Talk. Now, you've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that. But we need your help now more than ever. We need your help to make more of what we know that you love.
So here's how you do it. You go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the I Will Help button. It will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Must colonized people resort to violence to achieve liberation?
Won't violence just beget more violence?
Isn't armed struggle sometimes the only available option?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KLW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today it's France Fanon, Violence, and the Struggle Against Colonialism.
Now, Fanon is not what you'd call a touchy-feely philosopher, Josh. In his most influential work, The Wretched of the Earth, he says this: decolonization reeks of red-hot cannonballs and bloody knives, for the last can be first only after a murderous and decisive confrontation between the two protagonists. That's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, and he wasn't kidding around. He also said that for the colonized, life can only materialize from the rotting cadaver of the colonist.
Now, I have to admit, I kind of much prefer Gandhi's model of how to resist colonialism. I mean, Gandhi resisted colonialism intensely, but he did it without the violence.
Yeah, well, Fanon dismisses the idea of nonviolence. He says it's just a creation of colonialism.
Yeah, see, that sounds a little paradoxical to me. I mean, Fanon sees colonialism itself as a system of violence, so how can it possibly create the idea of nonviolence?
Well, you got to think about it this way. There's a moment at which the colonizers realize that the jig is up. And at that moment, they co-opt the local elite. So the intellectuals, the priests, the preachers, the movers and shakers, and the political class. Those folks become so deeply colonized that they start collaborating with the colonizers to keep a lid on things.
Oh, come on. Why would they do a thing like that?
Well, because of conditioning, right? So those folks are conditioned by the colonizers to see revolution as a threat to values like dignity, equality, individualism, reasonableness.
Well, wait a minute. Those are really important values, and they're really well worth preserving. You don't get conditioned into that. I mean, those are important values.
Spoken like another colonized intellectual, Ken. So Fanon would tell you, reject the values of your white European colonizers. Create new values for yourself.
Gosh, Josh, gee, thanks, dude. I love you too, man.
Well, I'm just channeling Fanon.
Oh, okay, channel on. Help me see more of this.
Okay, so here's the idea. The colonizers get so deep into the consciousness of the colonized elite in particular, that those elites come to endorse the alien values as if they were their own.
Now, this is alien? Equality, an alien value? That's a universal value.
That's exactly what the colonizers want you to believe.
Well, it's true.
It's a lie. And once you swallow that lie, it's easy to believe that nonviolent reform is the way forward.
I still don't get it. Why reject values like individualism or reasonableness or equality as alien lies? I don't get it. Why is that?
Well, so for one thing, those who preach those values are hypocritical. I mean, that they're claiming them for themselves, but completely denying them to the colonizers.
Okay, I get that. So just be more consistent.
Well, all right, but there's another thing, and it's an even deeper problem, and that is that the colonizers are going to use those values as weapons to atomize the colonized, to divide the colonized.
Look, I'm sorry. I prefer reform to revolution.
Of course you do. Colonized elites always do. You get a seat at the table of reasonableness and become an oh-so-reasonable instrument of the colonizers.
Look, Josh, Fanon or you or anybody else can call me a colonized black guy all he wants, but you know what? You still haven't told me what's so bad about reform.
Right, okay. I mean, the problem is that it changes nothing at a deep structural fundamental level, at least not for the masses. And that's why, on Fanon's view, it's always the masses who are the leading edge of revolution, not the co-opted elites.
So you're telling me he really thinks that nonviolent reform, the kind of stuff we associate with Gandhi or Martin Luther King, is for sellouts who are blind to their own colonization and complicit in not just their own oppression, but in the oppression of the masses they're supposed to serve? He really thinks that?
Yeah, that's what he says.
Well, but doesn't he see, come on, that nonviolent reform, if it could be carried out, it actually promises the best of both worlds. It promises reconciliation between the colonized and the colonized on the basis if they're sincere and work it out on potentially shared values, and it promises all that without bloodshed. That's much better.
No. So look, these two worlds, the world of the colonized and the world of the colonized, they're completely incompatible. The only path to liberation for the colonized is to smash the colonial world.
Okay, but what's the argument for that?
Argument? Colonists may offer high-minded arguments and pretty speeches, but Fanon says this: when the colonized hear a speech on Western culture, they draw their machete.
Gosh, what a downer dude, and what a bleak picture.
Well, colonizers may not like it, but colonized people the world over have found it deeply inspiring.
Well, I know that's true. I know you're right about that. And to give us a wider sample of the reception of this very challenging, provocative thinker, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to talk to scholars from across the academic disciplines to find out how they interpret Fanon and his legacy. She files this report.
I don't feel he's misunderstood. I know he's misunderstood. And deliberately so in many cases.
A lot of liberals, when they read Fanon, think, oh, he's so constantly angry. I think he's a man who deploys irony to the most devastating effect.
His energy and intellect were ferocious. And he was really unforgiving of people who didn't kind of rise to the occasion of giving the world everything they had.
He simultaneously wrote as a poet, a philosopher, a psychiatrist, historian, sociologist, a political activist, a humanist, a lover. He wrote as all those things at once.
Frantz Fanon grew up on a small Caribbean island under the control of a few French colonizers. He was a teenager when he voluntarily enlisted in the war against the Nazis. Jane Gordon teaches political science at the University of Connecticut.
He really believed when he enlisted that he was fighting for liberty. I mean, he was really moved by French Republican ideals.
But on the front lines, he found that to his white fellow soldiers, he was still merely a colonial subject.
He came back and said, you know, I was really fighting in a white man's war, where the people who were most directly implicated weren't even ready to make the risks that I was.
In his writing, Fanon would go on to challenge liberal European ideals and reveal how saturated they were with colonialism. He got a reputation for rejecting civilized democracy in favor of violent revolution. Lewis Gordon, who teaches philosophy and Africana studies at the University of Connecticut, says that's a dismissive oversimplification.
The first thing to remember is Fanon was anti-violence. In fact, he detested it, but his position was that if you detest something, it doesn't mean you sit passively on the side and let it happen.
The French did not receive his ideas well.
It's frightening to see people who are colonized or degraded stand up and say they'll fight for their rights. That's treated in and of itself as violence.
And on an interpersonal level, among intellectuals, Fanon was marginalized.
The very idea of a black man saying, I'm your intellectual equal, or in some cases, I mean, intellectual superior. I mean, Fanon's equals were people like Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, Simone de Beauvoir. Those were his equals. And so the very idea that he would never stand prostrate in front of a white person, in other words, he never kowtowed, demurred, he never presented himself as small.
But since his death, Fanon's work has only grown in relevance. Ashwari Kumar, professor of history at Stanford, says that in the aftermath of widespread decolonization around the world, people turned to Fanon to investigate why
decolonization did not actually make the empire disappear.
Fanon wrote about the economic, cultural, and psychological ways that colonization persists even after the formal political power is gone.
When you structure an entire society around a certain set of political and social relations and economic relations, you can't suddenly undo it.
Jane Gordon from the University of Connecticut says this time period and the question of what to do over persistent empire revived heated debates over Fanon.
Because Fanon was one of the figures who gave the most compelling case for not only the viability of revolution but the need for it, there was a lot of moves to try to discredit him.
His critics argued,
revolution is a dead project, it's behind us. We can't radically transform societies anymore.
For a lot of people who study Fanon, there are limits to how far they're willing to go with him. For Ashwari Kumar, it's Fanon's idea of cathartic violence, violence that psychologically liberates colonized people.
Many of us have been uneasy about that one place, that piece of cathartic violence that Fanon wants us to go in order to be just simply free.
Today, Fanon's ideas about radical change and violence have a new relevance. Kumar points out that the Antifa movement, with their embrace of violence against white supremacy and fascism, asks many of the same questions that Fanon did. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza, for that report. I'm Ken Taylor, here with my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today, we're thinking about Fanon, violence, and the struggle against colonialism.
We're joined now by Nigel Gibson, professor in the Institute for Liberal Arts and Interdisciplinary Studies at Emerson College, and co-author of France Fanon, Psychiatry and Politics. Nigel, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Nigel, you grew up, and I don't want to diss the country of your origin, but it is one of the world's great colonial powers. So how did you first become interested in Fanon, who is so intensely anti-colonialist?
I just graduated from the University of Aberystwyth in one of England's first colonies. And a young anti-apartheid activist, I came across this pamphlet by two Marxist humanists, John Allen and Lou Turner, called France Fanon, Soweto, and American Black Thought. And I was particularly interested in how Steve Biko in South Africa had appropriated Fanon and thought about Fanon through his particular context. And I was interested in what we might now call traveling theory and how you could use theoreticians from different periods and different contexts. And at the same time, thinking about the struggle in Northern Ireland during the high period of the Troubles, you might remember in 81, was the hunger strike. So it was all those events coinciding. I wasn't at the time an academic, I was just a sort of young activist.
Yeah, so I mean, you're referring to the struggles that were a mix of violence and nonviolence, you know, a hunger strike, but also terrorism. So what do you think? We started out, Ken and I, with a conversation a moment ago about, you know, that line about cannonballs and bloody knives. So what's Fanon's actual position on violence? I mean, is he trying to justify it, or is he just describing what happens, you know, whether justified or not?
I think he's doing both things, but he's doing more than that. I think he's trying to sort of understand violence. The first chapter in The Wretched of the Earth is called Concerning Violence or On Violence. And he's trying to figure out, you know, it's not just the colonial context, which is incredibly violent, one of appropriation and occupation of land and people. But also he's writing within the colonial war, the anti-colonial war in Algeria and also liberation movements in Africa. So he's trying to figure out how can you move what is essentially a violent, the internalization of violence and violence itself being played out all the time in society one way or the other. How can you move that towards the source of that violence?
Yeah, and I think
his
diagnosis of the colonial violence is really powerful. But of course, a question that comes up a lot around Fanon is does he seems to be celebrating violence, even though he knows that other options, like the Gandhi option, are available. So he talks about, you know, the violence is invested with positive formative features. It rids the colonizer of their inferiority complex and things like this. He seems to be celebrating anti-colonial.
Yeah, that it's a cathartic self-actualization thing.
Yes, he certainly is. But on the other hand, you have to read the whole book as well, because where he says that in the first chapter, by the last chapter on colonial wars and mental disorders, he's talking about violence as a problematic.
That's true.
In other words, how do you build a new society on top of all this trauma and violence that's occurred?
So
again, it's a kind of much more nuanced notion of violence than one gets if one just reads the first chapter.
I get that. I mean, he was a psychiatrist and he treated people who suffered from the trauma of violence, but I don't quite know what he thought. I mean, I know that in The Wretched of the Earth he says that the creation of the sort of impetus for nonviolence in some kind of elite within these colonial societies is just the creation of the colonial violence. But what does he think about people, you know, movements like Martin Luther King or Gandhi? And what does he think about those folks and that kind of resistance movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good question. But again, the problem he's facing in Algeria is intransigence by the colonial authorities, terror, torture, incredible violence of occupied colonial Algeria. So I think it's, you know, obviously King comes later. He doesn't really say much about Gandhi. And his critique of those who want to follow a non-violent path in Algeria is essentially that he sees them as not really fundamentally undermining the colonial regime, but wanting to come to some agreement with it.
Right, exactly. And that's out of their colonized consciousness and all that, which we're going to dig into a bit more after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Frantz Fanon with Nigel Gibson from Emerson College.
In our next segment, we'll look at the consciousness of the colonized. Is Fanon right to dismiss European values as an alien presence foisted on the colonized? And if so, how can the colonized throw those values off and create new ones that are authentically their own?
Consciousness, colonialization, and the recreation of value. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
That was MC Solar, a singer born in Senegal, comparing the colonial oppression of Africans to modern-day exploitation of the developing world. I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about the post-colonial philosopher Frantz Fanon. Our guest is Nigel Gibson from Emerson College.
So, Nigel, let's start this segment by digging deeper into something that Ken and I were talking about earlier, the notion of colonized consciousness. Fanon seems to think about colonialism not just as a physical occupation of somebody else's land, but also as a psychological occupation of somebody else's mind. So what does that claim come to? How is that even possible?
I mean, I think it's possible because, for a number of reasons. One, there's some consent among some colonized people to be colonized in the sense of that is the way of the world, and that one has to become, you know, to make it in the world is to take on the values of colonization. That's really the thesis of Black Skin, White Mask.
Right. So that's the white mask that he's referring to.
Right. So the colonized elite. Are you telling me that's not something he thinks of as something done to them, but as something they, in some sense, participate in and cooperate in due to themselves? Is that his view?
There's a structure to it. It's a society in which they live and grow up in. It's the reality of life. And there's also a consensual element to it, which is why he sees, you know, Black Skin, White Mask as part of the work of deconstructing that.
So tell me more about that, because it makes it sound different from slavery. I always tell students, I teach this course on self-recognition, I always tell students the worst kind of oppression is the oppression that blinds you from yourself, and it's really hard to make somebody blind to their own possibilities, right? The slavery may do that, but even the slaves have this kind of resistance. I mean, even in Du Bois's kind of talk of double consciousness, there's always the interiority that won't be fully colonized, that resist against how the other sees. I mean, is there nothing like that? I mean, Fanon just saying Black Skin, White Mask? Is it just saying, no, you know, they don't even have double consciousness. There's no interiority struggling against the colonizer? Or what does he think about those kind of issues?
I think there's more than double consciousness. If you look at Fanon's biography, it gives you a sense of where he's coming from. I mean, as a young man, at 17, he wanted to join the Free French and fight against Nazism.
Yeah.
So he very much saw himself as French and imbibing its culture and values against Nazism. His experience of the Second World War, he realized that French civilization wasn't what it was cracked up to be, and that Black Skin, White Mask is really about the confrontation of a black man arriving in Paris and not being seen as French, but being seen as black. So that creates like this kind of internal conflict. That in a certain sense moves away from a passive acceptance of colonialism to a reaction. The question then becomes, well, how do you react to it? You can react to it by in many different ways, as he tries to explain in Black Skin, White Masks. But many of them have failed. Somehow you have to destroy the internalization of the white master.
Right, and that makes excellent sense. It also seems like it's in keeping, very much in keeping with the Du Boisian notion of double consciousness. The part where it gets interesting and potentially controversial, it seems to me, is what Ken and I were discussing earlier about the, you know, how much of the ideology, the belief system, do you have to overthrow? So these, you know, universal values or quote-unquote universal values like equality, does yeah. Fanon really think that the colonized have to overthrow that in order to be free of the psychological colonial yoke?
I think Fanon is interestingly not a binary thinker in the sense that he's very much influenced by Marx, Hegel, Lacan, Freud, you know, Sartre, white men.
Are there any Nietzschean? Are there Nietzschean influences too?
Minimally, I would argue. But the thing is, in other words, he's not saying, I mean, he says at the end of Wretched of the Earth that all these tremendous values that are associated with European civilization, that Europe's failed. And it's really our job, talking to his comrades in the, you know, then Third World, to develop a new humanism. So he's not giving up universals. He's not giving up notions of freedom and equality. He's just basically arguing straightforwardly that Europe's failed on its mission.
So let me ask you about this. So Josh said to me when I pressed him on this point, he said there's two points, right? There is the hypocrisy of the European colonizers, right? They have all these values that they parade under, but they don't, right? But then he also said something about, which seems to me right as Fanon reads it, that the Europe has weaponized these values and uses them to atomize and divide. And he talks a lot about the divisions within colonized populations that are the result of, like, the weaponizing of these values. Like, right?
Individualism is a good case,
right? Like, yeah, but I could use a perfectly good thing as a weapon too in the right circumstances. Is it the weaponization of these values that's a problem, or is it that the values themselves are intrinsically problematic? I mean, I ask you that just as a curious. I don't have a view myself, so I just want you to enlighten me.
I think in a certain way the values are empty. It's not simply hypocrisy. It's also that, you know, they've raised these questions, but Europe has failed in the sense that individualism is the most narrow kind of notion of individualism. Fraternity is the most kind of narrow notion of fraternity. I mean, he wants, or freedom is based on the expropriation of, you know, the colonized lands and so forth. So in other words, it's a very narrow and particular idea, rather than what he would see as one opening up to really express human freedom.
I see. I gotcha. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Franz Fanon, and we've got a caller, Alicia from Berkeley, on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alicia.
Thank you. I just want to remind us that we actually became a democracy by taking up arms against the English, our colonists, and, you know, we didn't seem to have any problem with that. And what I think is really interesting is that the instances when the colonized becomes the colonizer, like, for instance, we didn't have any trouble trying to colonize the Indians, and we couldn't do it, we killed them. And Israel right now is having no problem colonizing Palestine, if you can call it that. So I just wondered about how you see that dynamic.
No, that's a good question. I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to ask Nigel that question. What do you think, Nigel?
Well, what he's, you know, the only time he mentions the U.S. in The Wretched of the Earth, he calls it a monster. I think it's a very good point. The kind of transformation into opposite of a struggle for freedom into a new domination. And he's particularly concerned about this in The Wretched of the Earth when he talks about the future of the post-colonial nations reinscribing the racism and the notions of hierarchy and dominance that that have been part of the colonial regime.
Right.
So he sees it as a real problem.
Yeah, and also the violence. When he talks in The Wretched of the Earth about the dangerous potential for violence to continue after decolonization. So that's I totally agree with you. He's very sophisticated and complex on this question of violence. He seems to see a positive side to it sometimes. I agree with you. He thinks that taking up arms can also cause PTSD, not just to the victim of violence, but also to the perpetrator of violence.
Yeah.
And he thinks, gosh, if you get in this sort of train of violence, how do you get off? So how do you see all those things? I mean, what do you think Fanon sees as the solution? I mean, how do you take up violence in the right kind of way such that you don't get PTSD or there's minimal PTSD and that it doesn't just continue in this endless cycle of violence?
And I want to add to that. Then I don't want to pile on to you, but I want to give you a second thing to think about that I think is deeply related to Josh. I mean, just think about the creation and recreation of value. If you're going to throw off all these sham values, right, and violently in this catharsis act of self-declaration, still, once you do that, you're faced with the question, who am I? And what do I value, what's the recipe for that? I mean, so it's a whole complicated stew. I see the negative part, but I don't see the positive constructive part.
I think you have to see the violence as political, revolutionary political violence. Mm-hmm. So it has to be framed, channeled, organized. That doesn't mean that problems don't emerge from that, as Josh was mentioning from the case studies in the fifth chapter, where he's talking about militants that have a militant who had planted a bomb, who on the anniversary of planting that bomb has a terrible sort of vertigo every single year, worrying about who he might have blown up and so forth. So the political violence doesn't end the issue. And he talks about having to bandage the wounds for many years to come.
Yeah.
He understands, but on the other hand, facing it fully, having to see a kind of everyone involved in the development of the new society. So it's not political party or an elite or a small group. It has to be very much opened up to the participation of everyone. And that's what he also argues in the chapter on the pitfalls of national consciousness. So I think in those kinds of new relationships that are developing with the whole nation involved in the most kind of democratic way, that in a certain sense is the practice of, you know, of a new value.
Yeah.
It's highly democratic, highly egalitarian, not worrying about, you know, and of course, all this might be considered and dismissed as idealistic, but he sees it as very, very practical. That, in fact, is the only practical solution.
So see, we're back to your he's a double kind of guy. He's a complicated kind of guy, because you mentioned equality and democracy. Those are the things that Europe parades under, but they merely parade under. But then if you don't just parade under them, but try to make them real, that's an urgent thing of national life and really hard to pull off. And he sounds like you're saying he recognizes how hard that is to pull off well. So he's a nuanced, sophisticated guy. But we got some more callers on the line. Ariana from San Francisco.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment about the cause of violence, revolution, and terrorism, and also two remedies that I'd like you to hear out. The first thing is that when we engage in war and colonialism, which America does, we're demonstrating a form of pathological narcissism in which we express feelings of entitlement for other countries' things. And some of these countries are the poorest in the world. We consign the people to the most desperate, anguished lives, and then they respond with terrorism acts or violence, and we wonder why that is. And then we overproduce goods and we undersell them and we cannibalize the planet. Now, there are a couple ways of thinking about remedies. One would be to understand that everyone is our brother and sister, and that sharing could end war and terrorism. For example, there could be a world food bank in which surplus goods could be located in one place and could address the starving people of the world. And then the second thing is that war needs to be understood as a criminal act, and the spoils of war and the motivations of the wealthy, including when they prey on their own people, like with the tax bill, the most vulnerable people, that those wars need to be outlawed, and that there needs to be a section of the United Nations to uphold those laws, internationally.
Ariana, I'm gonna let Nigel respond. You put a lot on the table, and thanks for putting so much on the table. I'm gonna let Nigel respond to whatever he wants to respond to in your on your comments.
Thanks for that, Ariana. I tend to agree with what you've said. I just want to emphasize that for Fanon, there's real material. We've been talking about psychology and consciousness, but there's also real material interests at stake, and we can't kind of let go of that.
But I want to ask you something, though, because we read those passages from Fanon. I know there's lots of context. There's these two worlds, the world of the colonists and the world of the colonized, just collide and are incompatible. That's not a recipe for a touchy-feely cosmopolitanism. That's a recipe for there's going to be a winner and a loser. You said Europe has failed. Can Europe, in some arrangement, coexist with the world that it colonized? I mean, you can say get them out of there, but then unless they're kind of roundly defeated, like the way the Nazis were roundly defeated, and pushed back completely, right? I mean, is it like a clash of things that cannot be reconciled in some cosmopolitan order, or what?
It can't come together as it is. So Europe needs to have a revolution as well. I mean, I think that's what Fanon is really saying. He's saying, the clash is between, when he talks about the Manichaeanism of the colonial situation, he talks about the rich colonial town and the poor colonized town where there's no shoes, there's no light, people are kind of hemmed in and so forth against this sort of riches of the colonial town. There, it's a zero-sum game. One has to be removed. Well, and so that's the end of colonialism. So I think his argument about Europe is that Europe, he sees the struggle against colonialism as aiding the liberation of Europe from its situation.
But right, this sounds like, I mean, we'll talk more about his Marxism and all that, but this sounds like worldwide revolution kind of talk, right? We're talking about not just the local battle against colonialism, but kind of a worldwide struggle that has to radically rewrite the world. Just tell me really briefly, am I hearing you rightly or wrongly?
Well, I think the anti-colonial struggle is global.
Yeah. Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about the life and thought of Frantz Fanon with Nigel Gibson from Emerson College.
In our final segment, we'll talk about liberation, identity, and class. How does Fanon's commitment to Marxism, with its emphasis on class, relate to his commitment to black liberation, with its emphasis on race?
Race, class, and identity politics, when Philosophy Talk continues. Is violence really the only way to chase them crazy bald heads out of town? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Nigel Gibson, co-author of Frantz Fanon, Psychiatry and Politics.
Reed from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Reed.
I guess my question falls in the category of the identity politics segment. About 40 years ago, I lived on the edge of the Castro, and at the same time I was reading Fanon, and it seemed to me a lot of what Fanon wrote seemed to me applied to the Castro. It was like a colonized population living there. And since then, a lot has happened, specifically gay marriage, the argument for which was based on equality. And so what we have now is a kind of assimilated male population. Would Fanon, I realize Fanon didn't talk about sexual minorities, but what would your guest say that Fanon would say about this phenomenon as it affects sexual minorities?
Good question. You got a thought there? You got a hypothesis, Nigel? It's like they become the bourgeoisie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you could actually read his critique of the national bourgeoisie from The Wretched of the Earth. I mean, applying Fanon, in other words, to that situation and perhaps get some insight into that.
Right. But that suggests, just playing with Reed's thought a little bit, that suggests that maybe this becoming the colonized bourgeoisie is not a bad thing. I don't think gays regret going from an aggrieved minority to a bourgeoisie with, I mean, there might be some radical gays that says, screw marriage, right? That's the bourgeoisie institution.
Yes. I mean, the question when you talk about gays, who are you talking about? Is this the majority of people? Or is it a small number of middle-class, successful gay people? It really narrows the question of gay liberation to one particular thing. I think that would be one of the issues to open up.
That's like those colonized elites, right? They become like the bourgeoisie and they leave behind the masses and they think they've got it made, but they're just an instrument. But I want to ask you another kind of question. So I think of Fanon as some kind of committed Marxist. I think of Marxists as emphasizing class conflict over everything else. But I also know he was an advocate of black liberation and the liberation of brown people around the world. Some people say there's sometimes a conflict between an emphasis on, say, racial struggle and class struggle. What did Fanon think about that? Did he see any conflict there?
No, that's a great question because he doesn't begin from that standpoint. He doesn't begin, although he's certainly an avid reader of Marx and interested in Marx, I don't think it would be right to think of him as a Marxist.
Really?
He doesn't begin from that particular point of view. And interestingly, in Black Skin, White Mask, when he reacts to Sartre's reading of negritude as a particular, in other words, black consciousness as a particular and class as a universal, he reacts quite strongly to it and says that, you know, that Sartre had betrayed. He certainly begins with, in terms of his own interest, he begins with black consciousness. He begins with the importance of national consciousness. It doesn't mean he ends there,
right.
But he doesn't have this kind of highly abstract notion of class from where to begin with.
Seems like he shares an intuition with Ralph Ellison. You see the same thing in Invisible Man. There's this tension between a Marxist view on which race is just a kind of a subset of class problems and a more expansive view that says, no, you know, even if you were to have the revolution, these issues might well not go away.
That seems right
to
you?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that connect, I mean, it's interesting, some early researchers from the 70s really made a connection between Marx's early humanist essays, like on alienation and so forth, and spoke about Fanon in those terms. That might be more fruitful than thinking about it in sort of economic terms of class and class struggle.
One of the things that strikes me about Fanon, again, I'm only, I have read shallowly into Fanon on occasion and more deeply in preparation for this show, so you know, I may have this completely wrong. But one of the things that strikes me is that he seems to believe, well, it seems to me that he thinks of colonialism as somehow part of the capitalist project, somehow. And then he also thinks that one of the things that the colonizers do is create and then exploit class divisions within the colonized people. So this is this thing about the colonized elite and who serve the colonial regime, separate from the peasants. He's got all this stuff about the rural peasantry and the urban sort of quasi-elite, the cab drivers, the intellectuals, that. And he seems to believe that somehow the colonizers are expert at both creating and exploiting these class divisions. Is that a fair reading?
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, there was an excellent essay written again in the 70s about how he reappropriates Marxist categories from the 18th Brumaire and applies them to a colonial situation. So you kind of get like a lumpen bourgeoisie, to use those terms. And the peasantry takes the role of the revolutionary rather than the proletariat, who are this very small privileged sect within the urban areas, so in Fanon's mind.
So he's kind of, I often think of the Marxist movements or communist movements around the world anyway as devolving into what I think of as vanguardism, right? Some elite speaking for a mute class that cannot speak for itself, and somehow they're supposed to be part of that mute class but speak on behalf of that, and all that stuff. And I always think, yeah, right, these haughty vanguards turn out exploit. I say the Soviet Union is supposed to be a worker state, but what happened to the workers? The vanguard said, heck with the workers. That's one reading of history, and it seems to me that he's sort of like an anti-vanguardist, right? The vanguard, the elite, they're part of the problem, right? And it's always like the peasant class that is the leading edge of revolution, which sounds very non-Marxist to me.
And also paradoxical, because he himself is an elite.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that's where one of the problematics is. I think the intellectuals, right, who are certainly part of the kind of middle class, are an important factor, a very important factor in his narrative of how, you know, the revolution begins.
Right.
And it's the kind of split off of more radical intellectuals in the urban areas who, quote-unquote, discover, you know, that the peasantry have actually never given up being revolutionary. So the intellectuals play a highly important role. So it's not just simply, you know, spontaneous revolt of the peasantry. There is an importance of organization. He says that in the second chapter of The Wretched of the Earth. And in fact, you know, in a kind of Leninist sense, there needs to be an organization.
Right.
However, that is most certainly not the end point.
That might be
the strategic point,
right,
but not the end point.
But that goes back to something you were saying earlier, that clearly the colonization of the mind isn't all pervasive, right? Fanon himself was radicalized, and so it's clearly possible. It's not that all of the intellectual class, responds to the incentives of accepting the ideology promulgated by the colonizer.
Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, Black Skin, White Mars is all about that, in the sense of thinking about, well, why is Fanon writing this book?
Right.
He thinks the book actually can aid disalienation.
Right.
If you think that, then you obviously think that
right,
people that read it can be, you know, can be disalienated.
So I'm going to ask you one last question. I admire certain aspects of Fanon. I admire his sort of searing courage and fearlessness. But there is this thing that I think he's won and played an important role in. Paul Ricoeur has this distinction between a hermeneutics of suspicion and a hermeneutics of faith. A hermeneutics of suspicion is kind of what he practices against European self-defenses of things like equality and reasonableness and all that stuff, because he says, look what really they're getting at. I think of him as one of the major sources of this. I mean, there are lots of sources, Freud and Nietzsche and Marx, but would you agree with me that one of his enduring legacies in the humanities especially is that we read all these texts, all these classical old texts, with deep suspicion? Now, I think that's a bad thing. You may think that's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing to read them through Fanon's eyes.
Right. Do you agree with me that he's one of the, you know, major movers and shakers of what I call the hermeneutics of suspicion?
Well, I suppose, I mean, obviously he's been dead over 50 years, but the whole notion of decolonizing thought, decolonizing the whole work of decolonization, yes, I mean, that's a work of suspicion in a certain sense.
Yeah. Well, Nigel, this has been a fascinating conversation. It's helped to decolonize my mind, and it did it without violence. So I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been really
fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. Our guest has been Nigel Gibson. He's a professor in the Institute for Liberal Arts and Interdisciplinary Studies at Emerson College. He's co-author of Frantz Fanon, Psychiatry and Politics. So, Josh, what are you thinking with your either colonizing or decolonized or colonized mind?
Well, I hope my mind is at least somewhat decolonized.
Yeah,
I've always been fascinated by Fanon. I'm more convinced than ever that he's offering a really powerful diagnosis of the psychological damage done by colonialism. And that's something that, you know, just didn't exist before Fanon. I guess it still leaves me with an open question. How much of the Western frame of thinking do formerly colonized people need to overthrow? I mean, Appiah has this lovely line, you know, it's not universalism that people are really opposed to. It's the fake kind. It's Western hegemony posing as
right,
universalism.
Right,
So for me, that's an open question. Maybe some of these values have to go, but maybe not all of them.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, cause, and I don't know that we got an answer from Nigel. I don't know if there's an answer in Fanon. I mean, once if you throw off the colonizers through this violent act of catharsis and self-claiming, you're still faced with, who am I? What am I to be? What am I to do? How are we to organize ourselves? All you've gotten so far is not that. But that's not a basis for a life in the world.
And you don't want to reject equality just because
some people weaponize the equality. Some people, So I think these are really hard things. And I don't know what the forward motion is, but you know what? I know one thing. This conversation goes forward. It goes forward at our Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, clicking on a few buttons. That's at philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now here is someone whose mind is so colonized he can't stop talking. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I was in college in the 70s, Frantz Fanon was on every lefty's reading list because he was kind of a dreamy guy. Handsome, a soldier, revolutionary, philosopher, and a psychiatrist, too. Plus, he died young, the way we like him. Dead at 36. He was literally dying of leukemia when he wrote his last book, The Wretched of the Earth, and Jean-Paul Sartre wrote an introduction to it, which helped with sales. I bet many people stopped reading the book after his introduction. It kind of misrepresented the book itself, near as I can tell. Sartre seemed to think that Fanon was giving permission to use violence and not feel bad about it. Sartre also seemed to think that Fanon wrote the book not for the Western reader, but for the revolutionary oppressed in Algeria or wherever, as a kind of how-to manual for venting rage. This meant that if a first-world person read it, he could pretend he was oppressed too, which meant permission for privileged young lefties to do whatever they felt like doing. This may or may not have led to a couple idiots from the Weather Underground blowing themselves up with bombs, also the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, maybe, which in turn led 400 police officers showing up at a house in Los Angeles to shoot it out with a six-person Symbionese Liberation Army. Close to 10,000 rounds of ammo were fired in that shootout. American exceptionalism at its finest. House burned to the ground, SLA dead, no cops hurt. Oh, and there was the Branch Davidians, I guess. Many dozens dead there in Waco. Lesson? Probably not a good idea to fire automatic weapons at police officers. It will not end well. Actually, that's the conclusion Fanon came to. He also noted that oppressor violence against the oppressed is what leads to violence by the oppressed against the oppressors. The trouble there, as we ourselves have seen, this leads the oppressor, that is the media, to conclude that the oppressed and oppressor are no different. Therefore, there is no oppression. Also, the oppressor generally blames the oppressed for violence. Before the Civil War, rebellions by Nat Turner or John Brown were considered random acts of terror or acts by unstable people. Black people were supposed to wait for the Civil War so white people could free them officially. White people won't like it, but they'll do it, and half-hearted cruelty will be the legacy still in the 21st century. It's ridiculous. The man is still coming down on the people, as Black Lives Matter has pointed out. This makes some white people so mad. All lives matter, they mutter between clenched teeth. Kind of misses the point, really. Stop shooting unarmed black men in the back at random traffic stops. Is that such an unreasonable demand? More recently, President Trump showed his gift for rising above an issue when he claimed that there was violence on both sides in Charlottesville, Virginia. Therefore, again, anti-fascism and fascism are the same thing, or at least equivalent. Fanon believed that violence begets violence, the violence that the colonizer absorbed by the colonized. That's right, cultural appropriation, which can lead to a new sense of self among the oppressed, a rising up, a burning, a cleansing, a fire, a catharsis, a new world order, once all the oppressors are gone or dead. Feeling that, violence on both sides also leads to PTSD, victims, bile, bitterness, regret, endless rage. So many things to look forward to, leaving us with the unanswered burning question, when is it okay to punch Nazis? Franz Fanon, thou shouldst be living at this hour. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I thought God gave us moral order.
There's no moral order as pure as this storm. There's no moral order at all.
There's just this. Can my violence conquer yours?